Welcome to this ICIS Chemicals podcast. Well, the coronavirus spread continues to accelerate in parts of the US, Latin America, Africa, and Asia, and some lockdowns are being reintroduced or strengthened. The European Commission published some depressing figures today, forecasting steeper GDP declines this year than its previous forecast in May. And yet China's stock markets are at a five-year high. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's warning that a no-deal Brexit looks increasingly likely. I'm Will Beecham, ICIS, Chemical Business Deputy Editor. With me to discuss these issues and what they mean for chemicals, today we've got Nigel Davis, who's our Insight Editor, and Paul Hodges, who's Chairman of International Ecom and author of the pH Report. Well, if I could start with you, Nigel. You reported that petrochemical prices have rebounded in June on the back of stronger crude oil market and recovering volume demand. Just wondered, how much of a rebound are you seeing in demand in Europe and other regions?
Well, that's the big question, Will, is the demand outlook. But when we were looking at the, European ethylene contract reference price was decided last week for July, it was quite a lengthy debate actually over that reference price. That was agreed up 12.4%. Obviously, a lot of that's got to do with naphtha and the that as well. But also, there was some outages in terms of cracker availability. But demand was saying some improvement for PVC, for instance, polyethylene pipe grades in Europe, as construction activity was picking up. And of course, those polyethylene grades going into packaging and medical and hygiene sectors still pretty robust, you know. And also, even some of the non-polymer sectors we were reporting, like ethylene oxide and ethylene glycol, they're still regarded as weak, but improving. So it's a question of, as we come out of lockdown, how much demand is there actually in the economy, and how quickly can that pick back up again as people go back to work? But as we all know, if we've been moving around at all, you know, as we come out of lockdown, activity is pretty limited, and we're not particularly comfortable getting out there, going back to work, going back to offices, with factories reopening, etc.
Paul, would you like to give us your outlook on how much of a rebound you're seeing?
Yeah, I think Will, we've got to distinguish, as Nigel was there, between recovery and rebound. That I think recovery, to be honest, and sadly, is a very long way away. A rebound is inevitable, and you know, if people are stuck at home for 2 or 3 months, well, furniture is going to break. Cars, you know, when they start, aren't going to work as well as possible. You have to go out and replace things, normal course of wear and so on. And if you take beyond that, are we feeling confident to do all the things that we were doing back in February and before? And the answer is clearly no. And you look at the number of job losses that are going on now. Daily, you know, thousands of jobs are going because now, of course, the furlough schemes are coming to an end. Governments can't continue to do that forever. And, you know, businesses are looking at the level of demand and saying, well, you know, we can't operate. I mean, if you look at the restaurant sector, you know, if you tell restaurants that they have to have their tables spaced out far more than they used to, I mean, most restaurants that we used to go to, part of the fun was you were crammed in together. If you now have to be a metre apart or 2 metres apart, depending on which country you're in, well, that means the sort of actual income for the restaurant is going to be 30 or 50% of what it was before, plus the extra costs of cleaning and everything else. It doesn't work as a business. So I think that, we can look at the rebound and we could say, yes, that's good, but you know, I don't think we're getting anywhere close to recovery, unfortunately.
I was going to say, Will, I think if you look to Asia and you look at what's happening, particularly from an ICIS point of view, you look at prices, say, for ethylene in Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia, they did rebound considerably. But now under pressure because of the the concerns about demand downstream in the wider economy. You know, and this is obviously in China, which came out of this crisis before everyone else, and also some countries in Asia which did very well in actually handling the crisis. But then, of course, we have other nations which are slipping further and further into the crisis. It seems to be the case, you know, with infection rates rising and sadly deaths rising too.
I think one of the issues is that you could look at something as an indicator, like crude oil prices, and you could say, oh, look, you see, everything's going well because crude oil prices have gone up, you know, 80-90% or something. But then you have to ask the question, well, who's been doing the buying and why have they done it? And the answer was, literally to a large extent, that it was China and India loading up in April or May on oil at $20 and $25 and filling their strategic reserves. So India announced a week or so ago that its strategic reserve was now full. China, according to Business Magazine, Coexin, also is within 1% of all its strategic reserves space being full. And they're saying, well, we don't need any more crude now for quite some time. So I think it's dangerous to look at crude or other indicators and then say, oh, things are getting better. You know, people made practical decisions, which made sense. But I would think that we're going to have another crash in crude prices now, because we've got to a level in the States where a lot of the producers can now restart and hedge profitably. You know, you're going to make money. You may not recover your capital cost, but you've spent the money. So that's not your priority if you're in a capital intensive business like oil or chemicals. Question is, are you actually making money over your operating cost? And can you pay your interest bill and stay alive? Everybody can. Similarly, I mean, obviously, you know, people are getting fed up within OPEC Plus about not being able to sell, and they're talking about market share wars, Saudi talking about a market share war again and so on. So you can see the third quarter is going to be pretty difficult again. I think we're just into this world of volatility now, where things are better one day and worse the next.
Do you think, Paul, that there's a chance, as the pandemic still seems to be spreading, lockdowns are being reintroduced, what are the chances of a return to that kind of rapid contraction that we saw in March, April, May time?
Well, you see, I think there's a very high chance of major volatility, because what you've done is the central banks have put large amounts of money in the hands of asset managers. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars here, trillions, you know, and similarly, governments have put money in the hands of ordinary people. And the ordinary people would normally be doing their sports betting and so on, but there's no sports to bet on. So they're all gambling on the stock market, and they're picking out names they know. I mean, it's a crazy thing, you know, Hertz and Chesapeake, the oil company, which are bankrupt. But, you know, on the days before they were bankrupt, because the share price went down to a dollar, everybody piled in and took it up to $5, saying, oh, this is easy money. And of course, if you got in at one and got out at five, you made money. If you got in at five, zero, you didn't. I suspect most people were like that. But, you know, there's, and the asset managers, what do you do? If you look at the Fed, it's just handed out hundreds of millions of dollars to asset managers. Well, they can't sit there with interest rates at zero. They put it into the stock market. What do you get? You get stocks like Tesla, which has never made money in its entire history, and probably never will make money. I mean, I'm very much in favor of electric vehicles, but I don't believe that Tesla is going to be one of the success rates. But it is absolutely perfect for today's environment. Why is that? Well, because it has no earnings. It's never had any earnings. And therefore, if I say it could be worth $200 billion, there's nothing to stop you, Will, say, actually, I think it could be worth $500 billion. And Nigel can come in and say, oh, come on, guys, look at this and look at that. And this is that happened. This, it could be worth a trillion. And there's no data. So, even turkeys can fly in a hurricane. And that's what's happening. You look at what's happening with Tesla. It would be laughable. Only these are the biggest financial markets in the world. And the power of price discovery has completely collapsed, which is not good news for any of us.
Yeah, you've also been doing some work on coal to chemicals, Paul, which you think's based on wrong assumptions about crude oil prices. What does that mean for the future of this technology?
Well, it is interesting. If you dig around a bit, what you find is that the States, of course, in 2010, 2011, made this wrong assumption, which a lot of us noticed and commented on, but it didn't stop them, of, oh, oil will always be $100 a barrel, so we're always going to have a cost advantage. And so they went into these major expansions, all, you know, completely wrongly founded. At the same time, China looked at that and said, well, if oil is going to be $100 a barrel, then coal can be very competitive. And so why don't we go into coal? Because we don't have a lot of oil, but we have a lot of coal. And so you get, you know, the two largest economies in the world going into an arms race where one is building out shale capacity and one is building out coal capacity. And what's interesting, there's been quite a lot of attention paid to the collapse of shale. What is also needs a bit more attention is what's happened with coal, because coal is clear, you know, coal to chemicals is clearly not a great investment, just as shale to chemicals is not a great investment. So what I think will happen is that all the plants that we've got will run, because you don't shut plants down. You've spent the money, but if you've lost it, you've lost it. That's the sort of thing. And so they'll run as long as the operating cost is paid. I don't think we'll see a lot more expansion. So it's interesting how one mistake has a ricochet effect across the market, and we get a whole lot more polyethylene and, you know, C2 and C3, of course, in the case of coal, than we needed, because people made that wrong assumption to start with.
Nigel, how optimistic are you for the future of coal to chemicals technology?
Well, I think, Paul makes the correct point there, is that those assets have to run. You know, they've been built and their operators will run them. And so therefore, the pressure is not so much on those guys. It's on the people who are using alternative technologies, who are, you know, alternatively placed, basically. So it's the naphtha cracker producing companies in Europe and Asia. And it's the methanol to olefins guys in China as well, who are really under the cosh at the moment, because the market's so bad. But then the coal to olefins plants will run. And by the same token, the shale, the big new shale based assets in the US will continue to run and push out product.
Thank you. Paul, you've also been looking at Brexit, that favourite topic of ours, with Angela Merkel warning that little progress has been made on a Brexit deal and it's time to ramp up preparations for no deal. The UK chemical sector has had a few years now to prepare for a no deal Brexit. First of all, how likely do you think it is that no deal Brexit's on the cards, Paul?
I think it's a 90% chance now. I mean, this is a political issue. It's always been a political issue, as we know. And the Johnson-Cummings government has got a majority of 80 in the House. So, you know, how could it lose that debate? How could it lose power? Obviously, the Labour Party and the Liberals and so on will vote against whatever deal they come back with. So the only way he could lose is if the Brexiteers, the European Reform Group, vote against him. So, in other words, the European Reform Group, who want a hard Brexit, have always wanted a hard Brexit, they are the swing votes. So unless you believe that Johnson is suddenly going to defy the people who brought him to power, you have to believe that there's going to be a hard Brexit at the end. And they dress it up and they call it an Australian deal. Well, OK, it's an Australian deal. Yeah, you trade on WTO terms. There aren't actually WTO terms. The problem is simply that we had the best possible deal because we were in the club. We had opt-outs from the bits that we didn't like, and we were able to, you know, make the rules because we were in the club. We were a senior member of the committee, if you like. Well, now we're outside. We're a third country, so who cares what we say, you know? And you have to remember, we're seeing this right now, that if you're an EU27 company and you realise that the economy is going to be bad probably now for the next 5 to 10 years, and you have to make cutbacks, well, it's obviously easier to make a cutback in the UK because that's not part of your home economy anymore. You know, French companies are not going to cut back in France preferentially and keep the UK open. Of course not. And you can look at the UK economy and you can see, well, it's clearly, you know, it's already faring very badly versus competitors. It's going to fare much worse from the end of the year. the financial services side of the country is going to have a real problem. I think it's just going to be very bad news, and we have to assume it is no deal. And there's not a lot of time to prepare for this, because nobody, the issue is really, if you were working before 1993, you knew how difficult this was, you know, before the single market, before the customs union. But if you came into the workforce after the 1st of January 1993, it's always been that you could sell to Berlin or to Paris or to Bergamo in the same way you could sell to Birmingham. You've no idea about, it's what you don't know that always kills you in these things. You've no idea how complicated it was. I mean, I was at ICI. ICI was the largest chemical company in the UK. It was the largest company in the UK. We were forever getting hauled up. I was hauled up in front of the tax people because I'd done a deal into Rotterdam and the tax bit and so on and so forth. It was a nightmare. And all of that went away, and now we're bringing it back again. So I can tell you, at least, you know, we had teams of people in ICI and other companies who've been doing this for 50 years. So you had, 80 or 90% of the problems were sorted out. It was the other 10 that got you. This time round, it will be the 80% that get you, because somebody in the chain won't realise they've got to have a customs declaration. Somebody in the chain won't realise about rules of origin. Well, in that case, you're snookered.
Nigel, you've been having a look at the UK Chemical Industries Association. That's the trade body for UK chemicals, and their reports on what preparations are needed and the complexities. So how confident are you that most chemical companies are preparing or well prepared for a no-deal Brexit, Nigel?
You know, as Paul was saying, it's the complexity. And I think the learning curve for companies is unimaginable, really. I mean, you know, where are the people in these companies who do understand the intricacies of the market in that level of detail when we begin trading, or if we begin trading under WTO rules, you know, from the end of this year, if there's no trade deal. And hugely, hugely complicated. It applies obviously to the movement of goods. It applies to health and safety. It applies to we mentioned rules of origin. It applies to REACH, the EU's and now the UK's mirror REACH, which is the regulation to register all chemicals sold in both parts of the world, in the UK now and in the European Union. And how do they apply? And then, of course, it's the intricacies of that. And, you know, you have to know where your products are going through the supply chain, and everyone in that supply chain has to know what they're doing. And Paul made the very valid point. It's just that 10% of what you don't know, or people who don't know what they should be doing and do something wrong, and that scuppers it for you. The Chemical Business Association, which represents the smaller companies, small to medium sized companies in the UK, along with 100 other company chiefs and entrepreneurs and business groups, wrote to the Prime Minister on the 1st of July, and a letter was published in the Financial Times, I believe. But they were, I mean, Peter Newport, who's the chief executive of the CBA, said a smooth flow of chemical industry products is critical to the economy to recover from COVID or post-COVID. You know, they are the foundation for most industries, and the good EU trade deal is essential, really, to avoid chemical supply chain disruption and a negative impact on the economy. Is that message being heard? I doubt it. And, you know, what will happen after the end of this year is very, very concerning.
I mean, I think that one of the points is that normally, and I've negotiated trade deals and WTO deals and so on, normally you're starting from a position and you're hoping in the trade deal to get better. So if you look at Canada, for example, you know, you have the negotiators in there, it takes you 7 years. And you know, at the end of the day, if it hadn't worked, well, you still had the existing position, which, you know, you were operating under. You were hoping to get better, and you did get better. So that was good news. Here, if we don't get a deal which is exactly the same as we have at the moment, then we are in far worse a position. If we don't get total access, if we don't get total approvals, if we don't get to, we're all going to be worse off. But the government doesn't care. That's not its priority. It has no skin in the game. All it's going to do when this all happens is blame Europe oh, they were intransigent, we couldn't negotiate with them, and so on. Yeah, the script has been written already. And it's all because they are an English nationalist party now. The Conservatives are not a Conservative party as we used to know them. They're an English nationalist party. And they don't care about Northern Ireland. They've shown that. We have a separate arrangement with Northern Ireland. We're not bothered about that. And so we have to recognise that this is all about politics and nothing to do with economics. And unfortunately, that means the economics are going to suffer.
Just finally, Nigel, what sort of preparations should UK-based chemical companies be taking right now to prepare for a no deal?
Well, they have to apply that forensic approach to their supply chain, really. And, you know, all of their operations, which will be impacted by, regulations as they change, or the law as it changes. We were talking many, many months ago about Brexit. And sort of silly, or what seemed like silly things like pallets, wooden pallets coming into the UK. How will they travel backwards and forwards across the borders or across the channel? Because they have to be, they are regulated. The wood in them, you have to know where the wood has come from. They are certified or whatever. It'll be something silly like that, or silly is not the word, but something very strange like that. Which will have a particular impact on supply chains.
Mm. I think that's a really good point, Nigel, because what we know is that customs officials are not there to allow you to let something happen because you made a mistake. Customs officials are there to protect the country and the economy from something. So if there's a doubt, their default position is always to say no.
Paul and Nigel, thank you very much for joining me this week. If you'd like to find out more about the services that ICIS has to offer, visit icis.com.